planted millions of kudzu seedlings to fight soil loss, a major fear in the era of the Dust Bowl. Renamed kudzu, the vine prevented so much erosion that villages across the U.S. Southeast celebrated kudzu festivals and crowned kudzu queens. People harvested it like hay and fed it to cows. Entrepreneurs marketed kudzu cereal, kudzu dog food, and kudzu ketchup. In the early 1950s, rural areas suddenly awoke from their trance and discovered that kudzu was eating them alive. Without its natural enemies, the plant grew so fast that Southerners joked they had to close their windows at night to keep it out. Worse, the plants themselves grew bigger than is usual in Japan. Nobody knows why. Engulfing fields in dense mats of root and vine, kudzu swarmed over entire farms, clambered for miles along telephone lines, wrapped up trees, barns, and houses like a green Cristo. The roots sank so deep that the vine was nearly impossible to remove. In 1996, the federal government estimated that kudzu had swallowed 7 million acres. The figure is now much larger. What happened after Columbus was like 1,000 kudzus everywhere. Throughout the hemisphere, ecosystems cracked and heaved like winter ice. Echoes of the biological tumult resound through colonial manuscripts. Colonists in Jamestown broke off from complaining about their Indian neighbors to complain about the depredations of the rats they had accidentally imported. Not all the invaders were such obvious pests, though. Clover and bluegrass, in Europe as tame and respectable as accountants, in the Americas transformed themselves into biological Attilas, sweeping through vast areas so quickly that the first English colonists who pushed into Kentucky found both species waiting for them. Peaches, not usually regarded as a weed, proliferated in the Southeast with such fervor that by the 18th century, farmers feared that the Carolinas would become a wilderness of peach trees. South America was hit especially hard. Endive and spinach escaped from colonial gardens and grew into impassable 6-foot thickets on the Peruvian coast. Thousands of feet higher, mint overwhelmed Andean valleys. In the pampas of Argentina and Uruguay, the voyaging Charles Darwin discovered hundreds of square miles strangled by feral artichoke. Over the undulating plains where these great beds occur, nothing else can now live, he observed. Wild peach was rampant in South America, too. Peachwood, Darwin discovered, had become the main supply of firewood to the city of Buenos Aires. Some invasions cancel each other out. Peru's plague of endive may have been checked by a simultaneous plague of rats, which the 16th century writer, Garcilaso de la Vega, reported, bred in infinite numbers, overran the land, and destroyed the crops. A phenomenon, much like ecological release, can occur when a species suddenly loses its burden of predators. The advent of mechanized fishing in the 1920s drastically reduced the number of cod from the Gulf of Maine to the Grand Banks. With the cod gone, the sea urchins on which they fed had no enemies left. Soon a spiny carpet covered the bottom of the Gulf. Sea urchins feed on kelp. As their populations boomed, they destroyed the area's kelp beds, creating what ichthyologists call a sea urchin barrens. In this region, cod was the species that governed the overall composition of the ecosystem. The fish was, in ecological jargon, a keystone species, one that affects the survival and abundance of many other species, in the definition of Harvard biologist Edward O. Wilson. Keystone species have disproportionate impact on their ecosystems. Removing them, Wilson explained, results in a relatively significant shift in the composition of the ecological community. Until Columbus, Indians were a keystone species in most of the hemisphere. Annually burning undergrowth, clearing and replanting forests, building canals and raising fields, hunting bison and netting salmon, growing maize, manioc, and the eastern agricultural complex. Native Americans had been managing their environment for thousands of years. As Cahokia shows, they made mistakes. But by and large, they modified their landscapes in stable, supple, resilient ways. Some milpa areas have been farmed for thousands of years. Time in which farmers in Mesopotamia and North Africa and parts of India ruined their land. Even the wholesale transformation seen in places like Peru, where irrigated terraces cover huge areas, were exceptionally well done. But all of these efforts required close, continual oversight. In the 16th century, epidemics removed the boss. American landscapes after 1492 were emptied, widowed, in the historian Francis Jennings's term. Suddenly deregulated, ecosystems shook and sloshed like a cup of tea in an earthquake. Not only did invading endive and rats beset them, but native species, too, burst and blasted, freed from constraints by the disappearance of Native Americans. The forest that the first New England colonists thought was primeval and enduring was actually in the midst of violent change and demographic collapse. So catastrophic and irrevocable were the changes that it is tempting to think that almost nothing survived from the past. This is wrong. Landscape and people remain, though greatly altered. And they have lessons to heed, both about the earth on which we all live and about the mental frames we bring to it. One out of every four birds. When passenger pigeons drank, they stuck their heads beneath the surface of the water until they were eye deep. When they walked, their heads bobbed awkwardly and they looked around from side to side. Passenger pigeons were greedy eaters with terrible manners. If they found some food they liked just after finishing a meal, they would vomit what they had previously eaten and dig in. Gobbling their chow, they sometimes twittered in tones musical enough that people mistook them for little girls. They gorged on so many beechnuts and acorns that they sometimes fell off their perches and burst apart when they hit the ground. But in flight, they were angelic. They cut through the air with such speed and grace that they were called blue meteors. When passenger pigeons found an area with grain or nuts to eat, they formed a long, linear front that advanced forward, heads peck, peck, pecking at the ground. Acorns, beechnuts, and chestnuts, strawberries, huckleberries, and blackberries, wheat, oats, and maize, all went down the pigeons' iridescently feathered gullets. To grab their share, the pigeons at the rear constantly fluttered over the heads of their compatriots and landed at the leading edge of the front. Then the birds in the back flew over them. The line of birds advanced in a continuous swirl, the conservationist John Muir recalled, revolving something like a wheel with a low buzzing wing roar that could be heard a long way off. Passenger pigeons traveled in massive assemblies, billions strong, that rained enough excrement to force people indoors. As a boy, Muir saw a mob of birds sweep thousands of acres perfectly clean of acorns in a few minutes. Pigeons destroyed farm fields so often that the Bishop of Quebec formally excommunicated the species in 1703. 110 years later, the artist and naturalist John J. Audubon saw a flock passing overhead in a single cloud for 3 whole days. The air, Audubon wrote later, was literally filled with pigeons. The light of noonday was obscured as by an eclipse. When he visited their roost, the dung lay almost 2 inches deep for miles. The pigeons, arriving by thousands, alighted everywhere, one above another, until solid masses as large as hogsheads were formed on the branches all around. Here and there, the perches gave way under the weight with a crash and, falling to the ground, destroyed hundreds of the birds beneath, forcing down the dense groups with which every stick was loaded. It was a scene of uproar and confusion. I found it quite useless to speak over the roar of wings, or even to shout to those persons who were nearest to me. According to Arleigh W. Shorger, author of a definitive study on the bird, In Audubon's day, at least one out of every four birds in North America was a passenger pigeon. In colonial times, the Haudenosaunee celebrated pigeon roostings by gathering around the birds for a massive feast. Horatio Jones, captured as a teenager by the Seneca, one of the six nations in the alliance, participated around 1782 in a mass pigeon hunt near the Genesee River. The birds, roosting on low branches, were too full and too stupid to flee. Men knocked them down with poles or toppled the trees they were sitting on. Children wrung the birds' necks, while women stewed them in pots, smoked them over fires, and dried them to preserve in storehouses. Sometimes the Seneca ate half a dozen squabs at a time, necks tied together in a carnivorous sculpture. "It was a festival season," Jones later recalled. "Even the meanest dog in camp had his fill of pigeon meat." In Haudenosaunee lore, the birds represented nature's generosity, a species literally selected by the spirit world to nourish humankind. Non-Indians, too, saw the pigeon as a symbol of the earth's richness. The living, pulsing, throbbing, and picturesque illustration of the abundance of food prepared by bountiful nature in all her supreme ecstasy of redundant production of life and energy, one businessman pigeon enthusiast gushed. Colonists grilled the birds, stewed them with salt pork, and baked them into pies. They plucked their feathers to stuff mattresses, pickled them in barrels as a winter treat, and fed them to livestock. Incredibly, hunters in the countryside captured tens of thousands of pigeons in nets and sent the living birds to urban hunting clubs for target practice. Then, suddenly, the passenger pigeon vanished. The last bird, Martha, named after Martha Washington, died on September 1, 1914. The passenger pigeon remained an emblem of natural bounty, but now it also represented the squandering of that bounty. In 1947, the conservationist Aldo Leopold dedicated a monument to the pigeon near the site of its greatest recorded nesting, at which hunters slaughtered 1.5 million birds. The plaque read, "This species became extinct through the avarice and thoughtlessness of man." The pigeon should indeed stand as a rebuke and warning. But if archaeologists are right, it should not be thought of as a symbol of wilderness abundance. Passenger pigeons' diet centered on mast, the collective name for acorns, beechnuts, hazelnuts, chestnuts, and the like. They also really liked maize. All were important foods to the Indians of eastern North America. Thus, passenger pigeons and Native Americans were ecological competitors. "What would be the expected outcome of this rivalry?" asked Thomas W. Newman, a consulting archaeologist in Atlanta. Newman noted that Indians had also vied for mast and maize with deer, raccoons, squirrels, and turkeys. Unsurprisingly, they hunted all of them with enthusiasm, as documented by the bones found in archaeological sites. Indeed, as Newman noted, Indians actually sought out pregnant or nursing does, which hunters today are instructed to let go. They hunted wild turkey in spring, just before they laid eggs. If they had waited until the eggs hatched, the poults could have survived, because they would follow any hen. The effect was to remove competition for tree nuts. The pattern was so consistent, Newman told me, that Indians must have been purposefully reducing the number of deer, raccoons, and turkeys. Given passenger pigeons' Brobdingnagian appetites for mast and maize, one would expect that Indians would also have hunted them and wanted to keep down their numbers. Thus, their bones should be plentiful at archaeological sites. Instead, Newman told me, they almost aren't there. It looks like people just didn't eat them. Pigeons roosting en masse were easy to harvest, as the Seneca hunt showed. If they are so easy to hunt, and you expect people to minimize labor and maximize return, you should have archaeological sites just filled with these things. Well, you don't. To Newman, the conclusion was obvious. Passenger pigeons were not as numerous before Columbus. What happened was that the impact of European contact altered the ecological dynamics in such a way that the passenger pigeon took off. The avian throngs Audubon saw were outbreak populations, always a symptom of an extraordinarily disrupted ecological system. Intrigued by Newman's arguments, William I. Woods, the Cahokia researcher, and Bernd Hermann, an environmental historian at the University of Göttingen, surveyed 6 archaeological studies of diets at Cahokia and places nearby. All were not far from the site of the huge pigeon roost that Audubon visited. The studies examined household food trash and found that traces of passenger pigeon were rare. Given that Cahokians consumed almost every other animal protein source, Hermann and Woods wrote, one must conclude that the passenger pigeon was simply not available for exploitation in significant numbers. Some archaeologists have criticized these conclusions on the grounds that passenger pigeon bones would not be likely to be preserved. If so, their absence would reveal nothing about whether Indians ate the species. But all 6 Cahokia projects found plenty of bird bones, and even some tiny bones from fish. One turned up 9,053 bones from 72 bird species. They found a few passenger pigeon bones, but only a few, Woods told me. Now these were hungry people who were very interested in acquiring protein. The simplest explanation for the lack of passenger pigeon bones is a lack of passenger pigeons. Prior to 1492, this was a rare species. Passenger pigeons were but one example of a larger phenomenon. According to the naturalist Ernest Thompson Seton, North America at the time of Columbus was home to 60 million bison, 30 to 40 million pronghorns, 10 million elk, 10 million mule deer, and as many as 2 million mountain sheep. 60 million bison. The imagination shrinks from imagining it. Bison can run for hours at 30 miles per hour and use their massive horned skulls like battering rams. Mature animals weigh up to a ton. 60 million of them would have been more than 60 billion pounds of grouchy, fast-moving mammal pounding the plains. Seton made his estimate in 1929, and it is still widely quoted today. Ecologists have since employed more sophisticated theoretical tools to produce new, lower population estimates. Ethologist Dale Lott put the number of bison in primitive America at 24 to 27 million in 2002. Nonetheless, most continue to accept Seton's basic thesis. The Americas seen by the first colonists were a wild land of thundering herds and forests with sky-high trees and lakes aswarm with fish. Increasingly, though, archaeologists demand a caveat. The Americas seen by the first colonists were teeming with game, they say. But the continents had not been that way for long. Indeed, this Edenic world was largely an inadvertent European creation. At the time of Columbus, the Western Hemisphere had been thoroughly painted with the human brush. Agriculture occurred in as much as 2/3 of what is now the continental United States, with large swaths of the Southwest terraced and irrigated. Among the maize fields in the Midwest and Southeast, mounds by the thousands stippled the land. The forests of the eastern seaboard had been peeled back from the coasts, which were now lined with farms. Salmon nets stretched across almost every ocean-bound stream in the Northwest, and almost everywhere there was Indian fire. South of the Rio Grande, Indians had converted the Mexican Basin and Yucatan into artificial environments suitable for farming. Terraces and canals and stony highways lined the western face of the Andes. Raised fields and causeways covered the Beni. Agriculture reached down into Argentina and central Chile. Indians had converted perhaps a quarter of the vast Amazon forest into farms and agricultural forests, and the once forested Andes to grass and brush. The Inca, worried about fuel supply, were planting tree farms. All of this had implications for animal populations. As Cahokia grew, Woods told me, so did its maize fields. For obvious reasons, its farmers did not relish the prospect of buffalo herds trampling through their fields. Nor did they want deer, moose, or passenger pigeons eating the maize. They hunted them until they were scarce around their homes. At the same time, they tried to encourage these species to grow in number farther away, where they would be useful. The net result was to keep that kind of animal at arm's length, Woods told me. The total number of bison, say, seems to have gone down quite a bit, but they wanted to have them available for hunting in the prairie a couple days' journey away. When disease swept Indians from the land, this entire ecological, ancien regime collapsed. Hernando de Soto's expedition staggered through the southeast for 4 years in the early 16th century and saw hordes of people, but apparently didn't see a single bison. No account describes them, and it seems unlikely that chroniclers would have failed to mention sighting such an extraordinary beast. More than a century later, the French explorer La Salle canoed down the Mississippi. Where De Soto had found prosperous cities, La Salle encountered a solitude unrelieved by the faintest trace of man, wrote the 19th century historian Francis Parkman. Everywhere the French encountered bison, grazing in herds on the great prairies which then bordered the river. When Indians died, the shaggy creatures vastly extended both their range and numbers. According to Valerius Geist, a bison researcher at the University of Calgary, the post-Columbian abundance of bison, in his view, was largely due to Eurasian diseases that decreased Indian hunting. The massive thundering herds were pathological, something that the land had not seen before and was unlikely to see again. The same may have held true for many other species. If elk were here in great numbers all this time, the archaeological sites should be chock full of elk bones, Charles Kay, a wildlife ecologist at Utah State, told me. But the archaeologists will tell you the elk weren't there. In middens around Yellowstone National Park, he said, they first show up in large numbers about 500 years ago, the time of the great epidemics. Until European contact, the warm coastline of California was heavily populated, according to William S. Preston, a geographer at California State Polytechnic University in San Luis Obispo. After Columbus, everything changed. The Indian population collapsed. Clams and mussels exploded in number. They also grew larger. Game overran the land. Sir Francis Drake sailed into San Francisco's harbor in 1579 and saw a land of plenty. Infinite was the company of very large and fat deer, he announced. How could he have known that just a century before, the shoreline had been thickly settled and the deer much more scarce? Not all of these claims have been endorsed enthusiastically. Kay's work on elk has drawn especially heavy fire. Elk are big, and Indians may have butchered them where they fell, meaning that few elk carcasses would appear in middens. Nonetheless, ecologists and archaeologists increasingly agree that the destruction of Native Americans also destroyed the ecosystems they managed. Throughout the eastern forest, the open, park-like landscapes observed by the first Europeans quickly filled in. Because they did not burn the land with the same skill and frequency as its previous occupants, the forests grew thicker. Left untended, maize fields filled in with weeds, then bushes and trees. My ancestor Billington's great-grandchildren may not have realized it, but the impenetrable sweep of dark forest admired by Thoreau was something that Billington never saw. Later, of course, Europeans stripped New England almost bare of trees. When the newcomers moved west, they were preceded by a wave of disease and then a wave of ecological disturbance. The former crested with fearsome rapidity, The latter sometimes took more than a century to tamp down, and it was followed by many aftershocks. The virgin forest was not encountered in the 16th and 17th centuries, wrote historian Stephen Pine. It was invented in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Far from destroying pristine wilderness, that is, Europeans bloodily created it. By 1800, the hemisphere was thick with artificial wilderness. If forest primeval means woodland unsullied by the human presence, Denevin has written, there was much more of it in the 19th century than in the 17th. The product of demographic calamity, the newly created wilderness was indeed beautiful. But it was built on Indian graves, and every bit as much a ruin as the temples of the Maya. Novel Shores. I once visited Santarém in the central Amazon during the river's annual flood. When it wells over its banks and creeps inland for miles. Forest paths become canals and people bolt through the trees. Farmers in the floodplain build houses and barns on stilts. Stir-crazy cattle in the barns stick their heads out the windows and watch pink dolphins sporting on their doorsteps. Acre-sized patches of bobbing vegetation, the famous floating islands of the Amazon, drift by. Eco-tourists are taken in motorboats through the drowned forest. Kids in dories chase after them, trying to sell sacks of incredibly good fruit. In the center of Santarém, telephone poles are made of cement, as is usual in tropical countries that can afford them. Wooden ones get eaten. At the edge of town, the authorities create poles by cutting down trees and propping them wherever needed. In a display of lethargy, town workers do not lop off branches, strip away bark or vines, or even remove termite mounds. After maybe a mile, they stop using logs and just string the lines on tree branches. A little further, the lines stop altogether. Beyond this, the river is occupied only by hamlets on the bluffs at the water's edge. The biggest building always seems to be the Pentecostal or Adventist church. After services, whooping kids fill the red dirt churchyard and fly kites. Sometimes they attach razor blades to the sides of the kites, and in a war of all against all, try to cut each other's strings. Except for soccer, rural Brazil's main sporting event seems to be attack kiting. Between communities, water traffic continually darts, hopscotching back and forth with the speed of gossip, even though many boats are still powered by pushing a long pole against the bottom. At the river's edge during flood season are small trees inundated to the tips of their branches. 30 feet above them dangles the red fruit of tall kapok trees, each scarlet bulb reflected perfectly in the still water. People make shortcuts through narrow tunnels in the vegetation called furrows. When I visited an old plantation called Taparina, site of an earlier Anna Roosevelt dig, the man at the tiller abruptly turned the boat straight into the forest. We shot through a furrow, 2,000 feet long and 6 feet wide. Some furrows have existed for centuries, I was told. There have been water highways in the forest since before Columbus. All of this is described as wilderness in the tourist brochures. It's not. If the new generation of researchers is correct. Indeed, some believe that fewer people may be living in rural Amazonia now than in 1491. Yet when my boat glided into the furrow, the forest shut out the sky like the closing of an umbrella. Within a few hundred yards, the human presence seemed to vanish. I felt alone and small, but in a way that was curiously like feeling exalted. If what was around me was not wilderness, how should one think of it? Since the fate of the forest is in our hands, what should be our goal for its future? European and U.S. environmentalists insist that the forest should never be cut down or used. It should remain, as far as possible, a land without people. In an ecological version of therapeutic nihilism, They want to leave the river basin to its own devices. Brazilians I've encountered are usually less than enthusiastic about this proposal. Yes, yes, we are in favor of the environment, they say. But we also have many millions of desperately poor people here. To develop your economy, you leveled your forests and carpeted the land with strip malls. Why can't we do the same? If you now want more forest, why don't you tear down some of your strip malls and plant trees? Yes, yes, we are in favor of helping the poor, environmentalists respond. But if you cut down the tropical forest, you won't be creating wealth. Instead, you will only destroy the soil. Turning Amazonia into a wasteland will help nobody. These dialogues of the deaf have occurred so often that the participants can almost recite their lines by rote. In a way, the words are curiously weightless. For the environmentalists tend to live in, or at least reflect views from, rich places like London, Berlin, or San Francisco. And the advocates of development are often from Sao Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, or Brasilia, cities that are thousands of miles away from the Amazon and culturally almost as remote as environmentalist cities. You should see people's faces here in Amazonia when we tell them we're from Sao Paulo, Eduardo Neves told me. It's like New Yorkers coming to southern Illinois, only worse. My God, aliens have invaded. Kill them before they infect us all. At the same time, the clash between environmentalist and developer cannot be dismissed. At stake, after all, is the world's greatest forest. And similar arguments play out in 100 or 1,000 other places that need protection. Beneath the entangling personal motives, the debate is one of the oldest in the Western philosophical tradition. Between nomos and physis. The ancient Greeks saw existence as a contrast between nomos, rationality, order, artifice, and physis, irrationality, chaos, nature. In environmental terms, Thoreau, who saw the landscape as imbued with an essential wildness that could be heedlessly destroyed, embodies physis. Physis says, "Let nature be our guide. Step out of the way of the environment, and it will know how to keep itself healthy." Nomos is the postmodern philosopher who argues that the entire landscape is constructed, that it has no essential, innate qualities, but is simply a reflection of chance and human action. Nomos says that no one ecological state is inherently preferable to any other, but that all of them are a product of human choices, even the ones with no people, since we will have made the choice not to go there. Accepting the magnitude of the Indian impact on the landscape seems to push us toward the Nomos side. In 1983, Cronin laid out the history of the New England countryside in his landmark book, Changes in the Land. In it, he observed that wilderness, as it was commonly understood, simply did not exist in the eastern United States, and had not existed for thousands of years. A few years later, Denevin referred to the belief in widespread wilderness as the pristine myth. When Cronin publicized this no-wilderness scenario in an article for the New York Times, environmentalists and ecologists attacked him as infected by relativism and postmodern philosophy. A small academic brouhaha ensued, complete with hundreds of footnotes. It precipitated one of the only books attacking postmodern philosophy ever written largely by biologists. Another book, The Great New Wilderness Debate, published in 1998, was edited by two philosophers who earnestly identified themselves as Euro-American men, whose cultural legacy is patriarchal Western civilization in its current post-colonial, globally hegemonic form. It is easy to tweak academics for their earnestly opaque language, as I am doing. Nonetheless, the philosopher's concerns are understandable. The trees closing over my head in the Amazon furrow made me feel the presence of something beyond myself. An intuition shared by almost everyone who has walked in the woods alone. That something seemed to have rules and resistances of its own, ones that did not stem from me. Yet the claim that the forest was shaped by people does not seem to leave room for anything else, anything bigger and deeper than humankind. Understanding that nature is not normative does not mean that anything goes. The fears come from the mistaken identification of wildness with the forest itself. Instead, the landscape is an arena for the interaction of natural and social forces, a kind of display, and one that, like all displays, is not fully under the control of its authors. Native Americans ran the continent as they saw fit. Modern nations must do the same. If they want to return as much of the landscape as possible to its state in 1491, they will have to create the world's largest gardens. Gardens are fashioned for many purposes with many different tools, but all are collaborations with natural forces. Rarely do their makers claim to be restoring or rebuilding anything from the past, and they are never in full control of the results. Instead, using the best tools they have and all the knowledge that they can gather, they work to create future environments. If there is a lesson, it is that to think like the original inhabitants of these lands, we should not set our sights on rebuilding an environment from the past, but concentrate on shaping a world to live in for the future. Coda. Chapter 2. The Great Law of Peace. Fleeing the Nazi conquest of Europe, the writer, Vladimir Nabokov, and his family took a ship to the United States in the spring of 1940. Although Nabokov was the scion of a Russian noble family, he detested the class-bound servility ubiquitous in the land of his birth. He was delighted when the lowly U.S. customs officers on the Manhattan dock failed to cringe at his aristocratic bearing and pedigree. Indeed, he reported, when they opened my suitcase and saw two pairs of boxing gloves, two officers put them on and began boxing. The third became interested in my collection of butterflies and even suggested one kind be called Captain. When the boxing and the conversation about butterflies finished, the customs men suggested I close the case and go. Their straightforward, even brash demeanor, with its implicit assumption that everyone was on the same social level, enchanted him. Nabokov was hardly the first émigré to be surprised by the difference between Americans and Europeans, a cultural divide that Henry James, like many others, attributed to the former's democratic spirit. As has been widely noted, this spirit has consequences both positive and negative. The sense that anyone is as good as anyone else fuels entrepreneurial self-reliance, but also can lead to what outsiders view as political know-nothingism. For better and worse, though, this spirit is widely identified as one of the America's great gifts to the world. When rich stockbrokers in London and Paris proudly retain their working-class accents, when audiences show up at La Scala in tracksuits and sneakers, when South Africans and Thais complain that the police don't read suspects their rights as they do on Starsky and Hutch reruns, when anti-government protesters in Cairo sing, "We shall overcome," in Egyptian accents, all these raspberries in the face of social and legal authority have a distinctly American tone, no matter where they take place. To be sure, apostles of freedom have risen in many places, but an overwhelming number have been inspired by the American example, or, as it should perhaps be called, the Native American example. For among its fonts is Native American culture, especially that of the Haudenosaunee. A loose military alliance among the Seneca, Cayuga, Onondaga, Oneida, Mohawk, and, after about 1720, the Tuscarora, the Haudenosaunee were one of the greatest indigenous polities north of the Rio Grande in the two centuries before Columbus, and definitely the greatest in the two centuries after. The evidence is unclear, but the ancestors of the Five Nations, neighboring bands of gatherers and hunters, may have lived in their homeland since the glaciers retreated from the Finger Lakes, The 11 deep, narrow lakes that lie like cat scratches across central New York State. Sometime around 1000 AD, the Indian agricultural trinity of maize, beans, and squash appeared in the area. Taking up agriculture, the Finger Lakes people, by now consolidated into five main groups, lined the region's hills with farms. Population rose, as has happened time and time again when human societies make the transition from foraging to farming. The burgeoning cultures took to fighting with each other. Because the abduction, injury, or death of a family member had to be revenged, every violent incident led to a spiral of brutal, tit-for-tat skirmishes. From this brutal environment, a heroic figure emerged, Daganoweda, the peacemaker. So little is known about Daganoweda's life that archaeologists disagree about whether he actually walked the earth or belongs entirely to the realm of legend. Various traditions provide different accounts of his background, but most say that Daganoweda was not a member of the Five Nations. He was a shamanic outsider who was born to a virgin girl in a village far to the north. Abjuring his past, he floated from his home village in a canoe made from white stone and wandered the Adirondack and Allegheny forests. Then a place of constant violence and, apparently, intermittent cannibalism. Daganoweda had a message of peace. He couldn't easily promulgate it, though, because he had a tragic flaw, a severe speech impediment, perhaps a stutter. Somehow he connected with Iyanwatha, an Onondaga who was a famous orator. As Hiawatha, this man became the protagonist of the historically confused epic poem of that name by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. With Iyanwatha as Daganoweda's spokesman, the two men confronted Tododaho, the powerful leader of the Onondaga, a shaman in his own right, and a warrior leader who was so deeply locked into the logic of prideful violence that he regarded the thought of peace as a betrayal. In the ensuing conflict, Tododaho killed Iyanwatha's three daughters, nearly derailing the quest for peace. Other versions have the girls killed in a raid by another group. Whatever the circumstances, Iyanwatha vowed that no parent would ever experience such a loss again, and rededicated himself to spreading Daganoweda's ideas. Over the years, Daganoweda and Iyanwatha persuaded the Seneca, Cayuga, Oneida, and Mohawk to form an alliance instead of constantly fighting. Tododaho and Onondaga continue to refuse. In a parley, Daganoweda took a single arrow and invited Tododaho to break it, which he did easily. Then he bundled together five arrows and asked Tododaho to break the lot. He couldn't. In the same way, Daganoweda prophesied the five nations, each week on its own, would fall into darkness unless they all banded together. Soon after Daganoweda's warning, a solar eclipse occurred. The shaken Tododaho agreed to add the Onondaga to the nascent alliance, but he drove a hard bargain, demanding that the main Onondaga village, now buried under the present-day city of Syracuse, New York, became the headquarters for the Confederacy. Despite all the convulsions of history, the Onondaga have kept the council fire burning for Haudenosaunee to this day, and Tododaho has remained the title for the alliance's main speaker. Daganoweda laid out the new alliance's rules of operation in the Haudenosaunee Constitution, the Great Law of Peace. When issues came up before the alliance, the Tododaho would summon the 50 sachems who represented the clans of the five nations. Different nations had different numbers of sachems, but the inequality meant little, because all decisions had to be unanimous. The five nations regarded consensus as a social ideal. As in all consensus-driven bodies, though, members felt intense pressure not to impede progress with frivolous objections. The heads of clans, who were all female, chose the sachems all male. As a rule, sachems were succeeded by their nephews, but the system was not entirely hereditary. Sachems could be impeached if they displeased their clan, And if their nephews were not deemed fit for office, someone outside the family could take over. Striking to the contemporary eye, the 117 codicils of the Great Law were concerned as much with establishing the limits on the Great Council's powers as on granting them. Its jurisdiction was strictly limited to relations among the nations and outside groups. Internal affairs were the province of the individual nations. Although the Council negotiated peace treaties, it could not declare war. That was left to the initiative of the leaders of each of Haudenosaunee's constituent nations. According to the Great Law, when the Council of Sachems was deciding upon an especially important matter or a great emergency, its members had to submit the matter to the decision of their people, in a kind of referendum. In creating such checks on authority, the League was just the most formal expression of a region-wide tradition. The sachems of Indian groups on the eastern seaboard were absolute monarchs in theory. In practice, wrote colonial leader Roger Williams, they will not conclude of aught unto which the people are averse. The League was predicated, in short, on the consent of the governed, without which the entire enterprise would collapse. Compared to the despotic societies that were the norm in Europe and Asia, Haudenosaunee was a libertarian dream. In the same sense, it was also a feminist dream. The Five Nations were largely governed internally by the female clan heads, and the Great Law explicitly ordered council members to heed the warnings of your women relatives. Failure to do so would lead to their removal. The equality granted to women was not the kind envisioned by contemporary Western feminists. Men and women were not treated as equivalent. Rather, the sexes were assigned to two separate social domains, neither subordinate to the other. No woman could be a war chief, no man could lead a clan. Anthropologists debate the extent of women's clout under this separate but equal arrangement. But according to University of Toledo historian Barbara Mann, author of Iroquoian Women, The Gontawisas, 2004. The female-led clan council set the agenda of the League. Men could not consider a matter not sent to them by the women. Women, who held title to all the land and its produce, could vote down decisions by the male leaders of the League and demand that an issue be reconsidered. Under this regime, women were so much better off than their counterparts in Europe that 19th century U.S. feminists like Lucretia Mott, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Matilda Jocelyn Gage, all of whom lived in Haudenosaunee country, drew inspiration from their lot. According to Haudenosaunee tradition, the alliance was founded centuries before Europeans arrived. Non-Indian researchers long treated this claim to antiquity with skepticism. The League, in their view, was inherently fragile and fissiparous. If it had been founded 1,000 years ago, it would have broken up well before the Pilgrims. And there was little archaeological evidence that the League had existed for many centuries. But both traditional lore and contemporary astronomical calculations suggest that Haudenosaunee dates back to between 1090 and 1150 AD. The former date was calculated by Seneca historian Paula Underwood, who based her estimate on the tally of generations in oral records. The latter came from historian Mann and her Toledo colleague, astronomer Jerry Fields. The Five Nations recorded the succession of council members with a combination of pegs and carved images on long wooden cylinders called condolence canes. Iroquois pictographs could convey sophisticated ideas, but functioned more as a mnemonic aid than a true writing system. The symbols were not conventionalized. That is, one person cannot easily read a document composed by another. According to Mohawk historian Jake Swamp, 145 Tododahoes spoke for the League between its founding and 1995, when Mann and Fields made their calculation. With this figure in hand, Mann and Fields calculated the average tenure of more than 300 other lifetime appointments, including popes, European kings and queens, and U.S. Supreme Court justices. Multiplying the average by the number of Tododahoes, the two researchers estimated that the alliance was probably founded in the middle of the 12th century. To check this estimate, Mann and Fields turned to astronomical tables. Before 1600, the last total solar eclipse observable in upstate New York occurred on August 31, 1142. If Mann and Fields are correct, this was the date on which Tododahoe accepted the alliance. The Haudenosaunee thus would have the second oldest continuously existing representative parliaments on Earth. Only Iceland's Althing, founded in 930 AD, is older. Scholars debate these estimates, but nobody disputes that the Haudenosaunee exemplified the formidable tradition of limited government and personal autonomy shared by many cultures north of the Rio Grande. To some extent, this freedom simply reflected North American Indians' relatively recent adoption of agriculture. Early farming villages worldwide were much less authoritarian places than later societies. But the Indians of the Eastern Seaboard institutionalized their liberty to an unusual extent. The Haudenosaunee especially, but many others too. "Their whole constitution breathes nothing but liberty," said colonist James Adair of the Aniunwia, Cherokee. Important historically, these were the free people encountered by France and Britain, personifications of democratic self-government so vivid that some historians and activists have argued that the Great Law of Peace directly inspired the U.S. Constitution. Taken literally, this assertion seems implausible, and historians' skepticism seems merited. With its federal government that can supersede state and local laws, its dependence on rule by the majority rather than consensus, its bicameral legislature, members of one branch being elected at fixed intervals, and its denial of suffrage to women, slaves, and the unpropertied, the Constitution as originally enacted was sharply different from the Great Law. In addition, the Constitution's emphasis on protecting private property runs contrary to Haudenosaunee traditions of communal ownership. But in a larger sense, it seems to me, the claim is correct. The framers of the Constitution, like most North American colonists, lived at a time when Indians were large presences in their lives, ones that naturally influenced their ideas and actions. In the rest of this book, I have tried to portray the scholarly consensus, the ideas that most researchers in the field believe, while giving due recognition to dissenters. Here I am about to voice ideas that most scholars don't believe, and argue that they should be given a second chance. My remarks apply primarily to historians of North America. South of the Rio Grande, the indigenous influence on colonial and post-colonial society has been celebrated for decades. Although it has not always led to teaching children there accurately about those native societies, or to treating contemporary indigenous people fairly. The native imprint is obvious in Latin American arts, the art and architecture produced by a synthesis of Indian and European styles from Mexico to Chile, the Clark University art historian Govan Alexander Bailey argued in a 2005 monograph, is one of humanity's greatest and most pluralistic achievements. But this synthesis is apparent in many other aspects of the culture, too, as would be expected in a place where as much as three-quarters of the population claim some Indian descent. North of the Rio Grande, the picture is different. As a rule, the possibility of such influences is ignored when not denied. To some extent, this is understandable. Indians were and are less numerous in the North, and most native societies in what is now the United States and Canada did not have the written languages, monumental architecture, or wide-ranging aesthetic traditions of their neighbors to the South. Yet the English, French, and Dutch, who took over the hemisphere north of Florida, were just as fascinated by native cultures as the Spaniards and Portuguese who emerged victorious to the South. The great European thinkers of the 17th and 18th centuries were much concerned with new ideas of liberty and the refashioning of society. How could they not have paid heed to the novel forms of government coming into view across the Atlantic? If they wanted to know the condition of natural man, where better to look than the natural men discovered in the Americas? Or rather, the people whom they believed to be natural men. To these thinkers, Indians were living demonstrations of wholly novel ways of being human. Exemplary cases that were mulled over, though rarely understood completely, by countless Europeans. Colonists and stay-at-homes, intellectuals and commoners, all struggled to understand, according to the sociologist historian Dene Delage of Laval University in Quebec. The very existence of these relatively egalitarian societies, so different in their structure and social relationships than those of Europe. The result, Delage explained, was to promote a new attitude of cultural relativism that in turn fed Enlightenment-era debates about the republican form of government, the rearing of children, and the ideals of freedom, equality, brotherhood, and the right to happiness. It is no accident that Thomas More, writing Utopia in 1615, situated his exemplary nation in the Americas. Nor is the frequent referral to Indian examples in the writings of Montaigne, Locke, Voltaire, Jefferson, Franklin, and Thomas Paine. Nor that Hobbes's source for his claim that the life of men outside society is solitary, nasty, poor, brutal, and short, was the savage people in many places of America. Nor that the young Rousseau should put some of his earliest thoughts about society and the individual in an operetta about Columbus and the Indians. The operetta, which is not viewed favorably even by Rousseau's most ardent admirers, was never produced. All were riveted, puzzled, inspired, and dismayed by what they heard of these strange new people across the sea. If these faraway intellectuals were much concerned with the lessons of native life, what about English and French colonists themselves, who knew intact native cultures for some three centuries? In the first two centuries of colonization, the border between natives and newcomers was porous, almost non-existent. The two societies mingled in a way that is difficult to imagine now. In a letter to Thomas Jefferson, the aging John Adams recalled the Massachusetts of his youth as a multiracial society. Aaron Ponham the priest and Moses Ponham the kind of the Ponkapog and Neponset tribes were frequent visitors at my father's house, he wrote nostalgically. There was a numerous family in this town, Quincy, Massachusetts, where Adams grew up, whose wigwam was within a mile of this house. They frequently visited Adams, and I, in my boyish rambles, used to call at their wigwam, where I never failed to be treated with whortleberries, blackberries, strawberries, or apples, plums, peaches, etc. Colonist Susanna Johnson described 18th century New Hampshire as such a mix of savages and settlers, without established laws to govern them, that the state of society cannot easily be described. In Philadelphia, Benjamin Franklin was equally familiar with Native American life. As a diplomat, he negotiated with the Confederacy of Five Nations in 1744. In those days, knowledge of Indian ways was an essential part of the statesman's toolkit. Among his closest friends was Conrad Weiser, an adopted Mohawk, and the Indians' unofficial host at the talks. And one of the mainstays of Franklin's printing business was the publication of Indian treaties, viewed then as critical state documents. During those centuries, Indians were greatly influenced culturally, technologically, intellectually, by colonists. It seems implausible that the exchange could have been entirely one way, that the natives have had little or no long-lasting impact on the newcomers. At the least, the claim is something to be demonstrated rather than assumed. As Franklin and many others noted, Indian life, not only among the Haudenosaunee, but throughout the Northeast, was characterized by a level of personal autonomy unknown in Europe. Franklin's ancestors may have emigrated from Europe to escape oppressive rules, but colonial societies were still vastly more coercive and class-ridden than indigenous villages. Every man is free, the frontiersman Robert Rogers told a disbelieving British audience, referring to Indian villages. "In these places," he said, "no other person, white or Indian, sachem or slave, has any right to deprive anyone of his freedom." As for the Haudenosaunee,